Thanks for listening to The Kick-Ass Life with David Wood. Stay connected on Facebook, / The Kick-Ass Life, on Twitter, at The Kick-Ass Life, and of course, at thekickasslife.com.
G'day. This is Stuart Emery, and you're listening to David Wood on The Kick-Ass Life Show.
Your life better?
This is the Kick-Ass Life Podcast with David Wood.
Well, hello, hello, hello again. It is so great to be back. I can't believe it. We're doing 3 shows a week, and last week we did 4. Hello, what's going on? Maybe I'm a little addicted. Well, you know, it's awesome. It's just awesome that you're here, you're listening. I just always want to start with gratitude. I don't know if you do gratitudes or not, but a buddy of mine, Warren and Arlene, sort of family buddies, they taught me something a number of years ago. We do it at our family table, and I urge you to do it. It's a great conversation piece, but at the end of every meal when we're sitting with the family, we do 2 things we're grateful for today, 1 thing we were good at today, and 1 thing that we're looking forward to. And the great thing about that is it really focuses the conversation on gratitudes, and normally the kids are all over it, and you have guests come over, and they're the ones that get a little bit wobbly about that kind of thing. But a little gratitude. Another word, great gratitude, is to wake up in the morning and do it. You may have heard me say these things before, but repetition is the mother of skill. And I was really interesting this week because normally we have a whole plethora of people coming on the show, and I'm a great believer that the universe always provides. And so what happened was there was someone who was booked in that had something occur, which meant that they couldn't be here. So here I am now with a sort of a show coming up, and this was late last night, and no one on the show. And it didn't worry me because, of course, we have, just a lot of people that we can call on. But I just wonder what's going to happen. And then I get a call from my good friend Courtney, and her and I have been partners and friends for many, many years. And she tells me about someone she sits next to on a flight. And she said, I think it'd be great on the show. And really, you guys listening out there, I want you to get this. You're going to meet all kinds of fascinating people. And this show is not about famous people. It's about real people, ordinary people who do extraordinary things. And so this guy shares his story with Courtney, as you would on a flight. And she's blown away by this young guy. He's only 30 years of age. And it really impacts her. And so she asked me to whether I'd chat with him. And I said, of course I will. But I had this instinct. I thought, rather than just chat with him, I'm going to get the recording studio ready. Because if I trust her, I trusted her my whole life. our whole acquaintance, let's say that, not my whole life. And so I thought, there's got to be something here for her to be moved so much. And because if something moves you, I'm telling you, it's going to move millions, because we're all moved generally by the same kinds of things. But I want to put the idea that, how he shared, what he shared. What he shared was the terrific adversity that he'd been through. And really how he came through it. So you can see by the title of the show that, this could be a show that could be really harsh to listen to, but it's not. There's so much hope in what he has to say. His message is so clean, even though his mother was murdered when he was just 14 years of age. And then 4 other people in his immediate sphere of influence were murdered. Murdered, not they didn't die. They were murdered. And there's a whole different energy around that. People die in accidents and it's horrific. But when somebody takes somebody's life, there's another energy going on there, which fascinated me. But what fascinates me more about this guy is really how he's been able to deal with it. And I'm going to introduce you to him in a second. But as I do, I was thinking about this. I was thinking about that great song by Queen, that wonderful Bohemian Rhapsody. I remember when it first came out. you know, there's that great part where he talks about this. I don't know if you know, remember these words.
Mama just killed a man, put a gun against his head, pulled my trigger, now he's dead.
And that's always fascinated me, that, you know, people driven to that kind of extreme. And sort of that in that moment. And as we listen to this young man talk about his journey and his ability to forgive, to be able to go back into the cell of this guy who took his mom's life and be able to find an area of forgiveness and the importance of that. His wisdom is so remarkable. And so I really want us to sort of listen in with that open heart. But here's something I've often taught. I've often taught the idea that, you know, within, I think of the worst case offenders in institutions anywhere. And you think of, you know, a pedophile on death row. Let's use that as an example. I've always wondered and I've always believed, and I could be wrong, and you guys can disagree with me on this, that inside that person is a piece of gold that was never seen or never rubbed or never really polished. You know, that the greatness that was in them was really ignored and somehow got buried underneath this other exterior, this anger, this other stuff, this other energy. And I think of the same with Adolf Hitler. And I lived in Israel for a year. And one of the most moving moments of my time there was at the Holocaust Museum, you know, and I mean, you can't do anything but weep. I mean, you just have to weep when you see what, you know, is possible from one human being to the next. But, you know, this is a kick-ass life show, and we got to be willing to go to places. We got to be willing to talk about stuff that may be harder to talk about. Because it's important. It's important stuff. And I'm a believer in transparency. So, you know, that moment for me of standing there at this in this museum in Tel Aviv and just like just bawling. I'd never been exposed to that, never seen what one human being can do to another. And then, you know, as I've traveled around the world and been exposed to so many cultures, I often wondered actually whether if Adolf Hitler had been to one of my programs, when I watch what happens at my programs and I watch people open up, especially a 5-day program like Beyond Courage, but even a 3-day program, you know, like, you know, some of the ones I've got coming up right now. But when I watch people open up and I see their hearts and I see that when people start to see each other and there's that magic occur of this deep connection, and that suddenly it's okay to be oneself. And that's what happens in the way that I design programs and write programs, is that people start to emerge. And what's interesting is, you know, that sometimes someone will appear invisible. In other words, I won't see them. And sometimes day 3 or day 4 of a program, they suddenly come into view. It's almost like their whole life they felt ignored or they felt unseen or unheard. A lot of women feel that, where they feel completely unheard, unseen, that they have no value. And I think they do. They almost visibly disappear from view. But when that beautiful part of someone's person, their heart, their soul, whatever you want to call it, is seen, and when they're accepted and valued, and suddenly you start to put people in situations where they're connecting and they're sharing and there's just this, the art of conversation, which I teach a lot. It's remarkable. And this young man, really, again, I didn't know if I was going to have him on the show. I just had a sense, trusting Courtney, that I would. And I'm so glad I did. I learned so much from him. And I want to share our conversation with you because, again, I recorded this last night. Because, again, it was off spec, never met the guy. We're going to meet. But I'm just very, very glad I did. And the lesson in here is so rich. So I want you to stay with the lesson in his journey. I mean, he went through obviously the ebbs and flows of dealing with a murder at 14, and then, you know, imagine years later sitting in a cell for 4 hours with the murderer of your mother, and having such compassion and forgiveness in your heart that you want to start to change the world. And that's what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. The Kick-Ass Life is all about that. It's finding something. It doesn't have to be much, and it's small nuances or distinctions that shift inside of us that allow us to start to show up differently. So I want you to sit back and relax, or if you're exercising, just keep on exercising. I know a lot of you exercise or walk, and you're probably out with the dog right now, and you may be dark where you are. You may be just getting up, jumping on your bike, and sit back and enjoy the very warm wisdom of Mr. Chris Ducharme. So I'm really excited about today's show because it's unusual that I haven't really known the person or met the person. But, you know, when a good friend of yours comes up to, or a good friend of mine comes up to me and says, hey, there's somebody you need to have on the show, and it's someone that you trust and you care about and you love deeply, there really isn't any questions in the back of my mind. So I'm really fortunate that I got to just chat for a few minutes with this amazing gentleman, and I want to welcome you to the show, Chris.
Good evening.
Yeah, and Chris, you know, we've only been speaking for a couple of minutes, and I know you're on a cell phone, you know, this is kind of like very, very, you know, spontaneous. But I really want to get to the heart of this conversation because you're a remarkable young man who's doing remarkable things in the world. And I want to go back to when you were 14 years of age and your mother is murdered. And I wonder if you can take us back to that moment and just describe to us what's going on. What happens to a 14-year-old when this happens in your life? What's some of the emotions you're feeling? And then we'll sort of move through this together.
Sure, I can. Thanks very much for having me on the show. I really appreciate the opportunity here. At 14 years old, as you can imagine, I mean, the adolescent years are kind of a challenging time to start with. But to learn that, you know, my mother was murdered. And, you know, we had real no answers. There was not a lot of answers that we were given. And it was a familiar person. It was a person that lived with us, and it was my mom's boyfriend. So it brought me to a point where I started questioning a lot and questioning, you know, the trust that I had in people around me, a lot of relationships. But I think that the way that society also treated us was a really hard thing to handle. You know, I had gone back to the same school where I was before the incident, and all of my friends that I had relationships with, I just couldn't relate anymore and didn't know how to talk to me. So I lost a lot of things, that, you know, and losing my mother was one, but really starting to question life and, you know, question what this is all about and why are we here and how can something so horrible happen to us?
You know, at that time, though, were you angry? Did you want to get revenge? Did you pick up a bat? I mean, what's going on as a young man? Are you terrified? I mean, you're only 14. I have a 14-year-old son, so I'm putting my son in that position right now, thinking about what he'd feel with my ex-wife, you know, if she was murdered. And I can't imagine what he'd go through. So what's going on for you? Was there rage or...
Oh, it was a series of emotions. The first few weeks, I remember pounding a concrete wall with my fist until my knuckles got bloody, and you know, and I just I think things got more difficult over the next coming years. I had, you know, got into, you know, substance abuse and feelings of depression, and you know, not suicide attempts, but definitely lots of thoughts about suicide. And I think I just was really alone, and I started writing poetry. So poetry really became a therapeutic expression for me that really saved my life. And but I think, you know, it was really, really hard to find people that could relate. And I think there was loads of anger. There was loads of I think anger that you almost redirect towards yourself because you don't understand why you're feeling the way you do. Some people have anger towards, you know, the offender, and definitely there's stages of that. But for me, it was just a lot of anger about why I felt the way I did. I just didn't understand it.
You know, I want to bring you fast forward, and I'm going to be jumping backwards and forwards in this story because I'm thinking again, as someone's listening in right now, and I mentioned to you just before you came on the show that, you know, we're in 140 countries, and obviously, you know, I believe that any micro sort of area of the world, any sort of small area of the world kind of is quite representative of the whole world. In other words, that everywhere in the world is feeling, would have the same types of feelings and sort of see this thing quite... almost the same. But, you know, last week you were in a prison and you're teaching on forgiveness or speaking about forgiveness. You're sharing this experience with prisoners, and you start to question this whole process of forgiveness. And you've spent a lot of time teaching on that. And that's really where I want us to talk about a little bit more, because I know that so many people have things happen in their life, not as extreme as this, but they carry this poison of either anger or hatred or revenge or regret, and it carries like a massive weight on their back. And you somehow at 14, here you are, you know, you have these sort of some depression going through you, you're angry, you're pummeling your fist against the wall, you're thinking about taking your own life, you know, you got nowhere to turn, the people around you aren't relating, and you have to find some way to get through this. And was forgiveness the key?
Yes, forgiveness was ultimately the key. You know, I don't think I would have been able to sustain my life if I had kept that resentment and anger inside. The forgiveness piece was more than just forgiveness. It was a state of acceptance, and it was also, I had gone to the prison in 1999 to meet with my mom's killer, and I had written a forgiveness letter, you know, a letter to him, and then I went in there and had a 4-hour conversation. And you know, I think at that point the forgiveness was from more of a spiritual, religious or Christian based place. And over the coming years after that, I started really questioning, you know, did I really forgive him, and where was that from? And now I'm at a place where, I mean, for me to even go into prison, last Wednesday was the first time I've been in a prison since 1999, when I went in and saw my mom's killer, Brock, right? And it brought me to a place where actually I could listen to these inmates telling their stories and have a complete compassion for them. And that wasn't the first time. I mean, I've had them come, you know, to speak at universities with me and such, but seeing them in the institution and in that setting really started challenging me to look at humanity and how can I forgive? Well, I can forgive because these people are people, you know, they're not just prisoners. They also have families. They also have a soul. And I also look at my life and I kind of go, well, I have made mistakes of my own. I mean, we all have, and I've had to be forgiven by other people too. But at the end of the day, you know, the best revenge that you can have is happiness. And if you're not going to live your life and you're going to live in misery and anger and hatred, well, then that's just going to bring more hatred back to you. So I think part of it's a selfish forgiveness, but I'm starting to feel more compassion, which I think is out of love.
I want to go back and understand this a little bit more, because obviously, you know, as I'm hearing you speak and sort of putting this journey together, the idea, no, it's fabulous what you're sharing. It's so important. But the idea that you decided to go back to this prison and spend 4 hours talking to your mom's killer, and he's someone obviously that you trusted into your home. He broke that trust and he took your mother's life. But that catalyst of you going to the prison that day, what was that brought on by? Did you meet someone? Was there someone that gave you the idea of forgiveness? Did you find that path? Or was it just through your poetry? You started writing, and within the words of your poetry, you found that ability to step into that place in that prison?
Sure. The answer is kind of multifaceted. It's from a lot of different places that I made that trip to see him. I started writing 9 months after my mom was killed, and my aunt had always encouraged me to write my thoughts down, write my questions down, anything I had, just write it down. And over the next few years, I felt like all the questions I had weren't being answered by the Canadian justice system. You know, the corrections, the investigators, you know, I wasn't getting the answers that I needed. So one of the reasons going to the prison was really to get some of those answers resolved. So I went in with 36 questions, and I ended up coming out with, you know, maybe 7 of them answered, because that's all we had time for. But going in was a combination of the writing. It was a combination of my spiritual growth. The people that introduced me to the opportunity was some people very well known here in Vancouver, British Columbia, that they run a program called Community Justice Initiatives. And that program is set up to, there's one program within their organization that's called Victim Offender Mediation. And that Victim Offender Mediation program allowed for me as a victim to meet with the offender, and it's a mutual agreement, right? So the offender agreed, I agreed, and I also had to display my intentions before going into the prison so that they could, you know, ensure that it was a safe environment.
Right, right.
And, you know, it didn't come with hardship. I mean, I had nightmares the days leading up to going in, and it was a really, really difficult thing. The moment one of the dreams that I actually had was that he tried attacking me in the prison across from the table, and I picked up the Bible that I had, and I hit him on the head with it and basically killed him, and then that's when I woke up. And so those were kind of the dreams that I had. And I'd have to say, and even, you know, after the forgiveness piece, I also felt challenged. You know, I started turning into more drinking and you know, some drugs. But then after a couple of years, I started realizing that I felt safe. You know, that was one of the questions I asked Brock was, you know, are you ever going to harm me? And so I felt safe going forward. And that was a really healing part of a big part of the healing process for me as well.
Hmm. And when you were
forgiving him and shaking his hand, and it was a really awkward thing to be in the same room as him and to actually forgive him. But I just felt like it's something that I needed to do.
And you talk about this idea that you kind of forgave him sort of in one sense at that time. And then as you've evolved and you started doing this amazing work, and I want you to share a little bit about the work you do now and how you've dedicated your life to a very special cause. You've sort of started to get much more awareness, and you start talking about forgiveness and compassion as one word, and compassion sort of becoming more overriding than forgiveness. Am I getting this right? Am I hearing what you're saying?
Yeah, yes, you are. And it's a very new realization for me, and I normally don't talk about new realizations because I don't know how sure I am about them, but the experience. This all came from an experience that I had on Wednesday when one of the inmates asked me, he said, I'm just trying to remember here how he said it. He didn't even ask me a question. What he did was he shared a story. He said, I murdered my girlfriend, and the family, not only do they forgive me, but they're treating me like family and they want the best for me. They truly want me to feel that they've forgiven me. And I just kind of listened to that. And he said that was the most awkward and most challenging part of him being in prison, was that he didn't feel like he deserved that kind of compassion or that kind of forgiveness. He felt like maybe they can forgive me for this, but they're actually trying to, you know, to help him. And so I think there's a huge power in that. The work that I do, though, is not with offenders per se. This is a pretty rare occurrence that I go into the prisons, but the focus that I put is 100% on victims, because the offenders have a lot of programming in the prisons. They have a lot of, there's a lot more funding that goes into sustaining an inmate or a prisoner, as opposed to how much is actually spent on victims' issues and victim support. So my cause is just that. I don't know if you want me to go there yet.
Yeah, well, yeah, I wouldn't mind you sharing a little bit, because obviously you've stepped into this world where you mentioned to me just before the call, and we only spoke for a couple of minutes. So, and this is really, really enlightening for me, because I teach a lot on forgiveness, and I realize in my own understanding the importance of it. But for you, you know, you've gone through something, and it wasn't just your mom. I mean, there were five murders close to you in a short period of time. And now, can you describe the two roles you play in the organizations that you're a part of?
Sure. So So the first role, when I moved to Vancouver 4 years ago, there was not one single support group for homicide victims in British Columbia. So a province of, 3.5 million, 4 million people. We didn't have any programs. Actually, in Western Canada, the only support group for victims of homicide that existed was in Edmonton. And so that was a vision I had, was we have the downtown east side and we need to create something here. Well, the Edmonton, the British Columbia Bereavement Helpline, before I even knew that they existed, were getting a lot of calls from victims. And so they contacted the group in Edmonton asking if they knew of anything in British Columbia, and they had referred them on to me when I moved here because they knew that's something I wanted to start it up. So I became a board member on the British Columbia Bereavement Helpline. This will be coming up to 4 years now, and just recently in the last year, I became a president of the organization, which has been around for 25 years, so it's quite a credible organization. However, the original intention for me to join the board was not to be in this role. It was actually to create the victims of homicide groups. And so for 4 years, dedicated my life every day almost for the last 4 years. And in the last year, we were able to fundraise just over $100,000 through Scotiabank charity event and through a funding commitment from the Department of Justice Canada and some other partners as well, including Simon Fraser University. And the amount of victims, I was able to speak at four national events across Canada last year and meet about 350 to 400 victims and hear their personal stories. And I'm telling you that has brought so much joy into my life. And, it sounds a little bit strange, I can imagine, from an outsider. But when you start hearing these people, sharing their experiences, that's their process. They're starting to process their grief. And if you can be a part of that, I just think it's such a special opportunity to show them the opportunities that they have.
And you talked about something earlier, which I found fascinating, where you talked about your friends couldn't relate, and you kind of went through this bereavement of your mother, but then this kind of bereavement of your friends. It's almost like you almost became an outcast by the circumstances of what happened. Is that common? Is that common in this process and in other processes you've seen?
More than I think, more than I can even describe. I just got back from this conference in the States, and friends of my parents that their son was murdered in 2009 in Edmonton, they said without the support network in Edmonton, they don't think they'd be here right now. And, I can even just tell in the first couple of years, they were not getting out of the house. They were not interacting with people because they just felt like they had no friends anymore. And they just told me this like even 2 weeks ago, that they're just starting to feel like they can have, more fun in their lives. But their network now exists. It's a support group. It's the victims that's their circle of people now. I know one other participant of our program, the support groups we created in Vancouver, she said, this support group, because it was a monthly drop-in, she said, I look forward to going to that. That's the highlight of my month, is to go to that support group. And, we were just thinking, how sad is that? That their highest point of their entire month is to go and sit in a circle of other people who have been affected by murder. So it is sad in one way, but it's also a very inspiring statement, I think. So yes, it's isolation and fear of trusting people, fear of putting that trust back in society and into our relationships. It's a lifelong challenge that I've heard from many, many victims.
I had a friend of mine who died of cancer, and I remember I used to drive 8 hours to go visit him, and that was a similar thing. He was terminal, and he almost died a social death before he died a physical death. And it was the same thing. People became awkward and they didn't know what to do. And I'd just go sit there and BS with him and chat and laugh, and when he could laugh, and he wanted to talk about what was going on. And do you think that crosses over? It's not just this victims of murder, but do you think there's a lot of situations where people, because they don't know how to handle it, they don't handle it at all, and they pull back and they leave the person sort of suffering on their own?
Yeah, no, I can agree with you. I think that, you know, with if I use some statistics here, the helpline, the BC Bereavement Helpline has networked, has helped over 36,000 callers in the last 25 years. And a very common theme with almost the majority, if not everybody that calls in, is unresolved grief. And you know, if they don't resolve grief, then typically that leads to other things that create more hardship. But also you'll hear from professionals all across the world. I just got back from a Tony Robbins conference. I just got back from, you know, these Dr. Wolfelt. I mean, these people, these professionals are stating, if you don't share it, it's not going to get you ahead, and sharing and talking about it is the most therapeutic thing you can do.
And that sort of leads us to, I think, something that, you know, everyone on the call obviously is not dealing with bereavement of through murder, but the lessons that you've learned over these years. I mean, you were 14, you're 30 now. So, you know, you've had these 16 years now where you've gone through the sort of the ebb and flow of you know, being on the point of maybe taking your own life, to drug abuse, to alcohol abuse, and then to sort of finding clarity and forgiveness. When we look at this, you said about dealing with grief and forgiveness. You mentioned earlier that there's sort of five areas of forgiveness that you've experienced. And you mentioned clearly that, you know, you don't teach on this necessarily, but you do talk about forgiveness a lot. Can you share, you know, if we were to relate this to anything, somebody in life going through and carrying grief or carrying regret or carrying hatred or anger, all these different things, can we sort of use this subject as a springboard to all these types of conversations?
Oh, yes. I think regardless of what type of grief it is, you know, there is going to be a question of anger and resentment. And I mean, it's part of the process, right? Everybody's going to experience that. If you don't, typically you're not either being honest with yourself, or you're turning to alcohol and drugs to numb that pain, which a lot of people do. I'm kind of having a hard time finding the right words here, but in my life, the poetry, that expression of just free flow and not having to worry about who's listening or who's there, sharing can come in many forms. It doesn't always have to come in sharing, you know, with somebody. Sometimes you can just share on paper, and you can choose to share that with who you want. But the freedom in being able to express yourself in such a raw form and not have to worry about how it's being judged or perceived or anything. I think that, and, you know, painting or getting out and running or doing physical activity, all of that is equally as important depending on your personality and what you need in your life, right?
Right, right.
And, yeah.
Did you want to say more about that?
No, I think that
let's talk about these five areas of forgiveness, because can you sort of articulate those a little bit more and share with me what you've experienced. And again, I understand that you may not be an expert in this area, but you've gone through this and you've helped a lot of people through this process. So from an experiential point of view, I wonder if you can share a little bit about that process that you've gone through so much in the last 16 years.
Sure. Well, I can't say sure here, because I'm actually, the last time I spoke on forgiveness in a more formal setting was in my university. So back at Concordia University College of Alberta. And when I was there, I had the opportunity to lead some chapel services. And there are, you know, there were from my memory, five types of forgivenesses. Five types of forgiveness. And I honestly don't know if I can recall what those are from the top of my head. And so I can't speak too much on the specifics of it.
But there are So if someone was wanting then to, or for you, for your process, and I appreciate this, and again, because we haven't really spoken before the call, and this is so important, again, even myself, as I'm listening to you right now, this idea of stepping into forgiveness, and you've talked about this one process of sharing, of writing, of journaling, of getting a physical involvement, but then that next part where you actually have to forgive, and then you talked about that's progression from that sort of initial forgiveness, which was really about you said. And then there was this quote of later forgiveness, which became more about the victim. Can you talk a little bit more about that so people can grasp that journey you went on?
Sure. Yeah, forgiveness. When I did meet with Brock in 99, I was at a place that I was just so low. And I was kind of raised in a home where there was a lot of alcoholism and abuse, and I knew that if I didn't stop it, if I didn't, forgive, you know, most people or anybody that's harmed me, then I'm going to basically hold that resentment towards other people or towards society and not allow myself to trust. And the forgiveness that I had going in was just so that I could be a better person. I thought, you know, from a Christian standpoint, if I, you know, forgave, then I'd be forgiven. And I think I did it more because I felt I should. It was part of my Christian piece at the time. But also, it was very selfish in the fact that I just thought if I forgave him, then I would be able to live a better life and I would be able to be happier. And, you know, there's a huge part of that that's true. Because I have been happier and I have been able to do a lot of the things that I'm passionate about and excited about. And I wouldn't have been able to do those or even connect with these victims and help community if I didn't forgive back then. But the forgiveness was almost at the point accepting that there's bad and good in the world. And I forgive, I don't forgive him, but I forgive him for what he did. I forgive the act, you know, because I know that it could have happened to anybody. But as time went on, I started looking and I started kind of wondering how can he be like, how different is he from myself? I mean, I have not harmed, you know, a lot of people, but I had a relationship last year that I did harm someone, and it was someone that I love very much, and to try to understand why I would even surprise myself at something I did really got me thinking, you know, that we don't always know why we do bad things and why we do hurtful things to other people. And so it started making me question them and where they're at. Well, maybe these people in the prison are in the same situation. Maybe they're like, well, why would I have done that? Why? And they beat themselves up for 10, 20 years in prison with very little, support or feedback from the families. And that's why I think restorative justice, and that's not something I've brought up in this conversation yet, but restorative justice is that process of victim-offender mediation. And it doesn't always involve forgiveness, but it definitely involves interaction with the offender and the victim. And it's about repairing the harm that's been done. And I think accountability is also a piece of that. You know, sometimes in Canada, our justice system is so much focused on punishment that it forgets to look at the actual responsibility of the act and the outcome and the consequences that it's created. And victims, then there's no connection between the victim and the offender, which if you go back to the very, you know, historical, like very, primitive times, you offend someone, well, you try to make that, you try to, you know, to make amends. I mean, that's part of that process, right?
Yeah.
If I stole some crab apples and, you know, someone caught me, well, then I would have to go and apologize to people that I stole crab apples from, right? And they'd say, okay, well, you know, it's very rudimentary thinking, but it's also, it's so basic, but it has such a great meaning and backbone to it, I think.
But this idea, how you've gone, Chris, into this compassionate part now, where you start to see your own areas of humanity, that you have those light and dark parts, that you have the possibility to hurt. And I want to ask, just for clarity for people listening in, when you say you hurt your girlfriend, was that a physical hurt or a mental hurt, emotional hurt? Was it all of them, or?
No, I think it was an emotional hurt. Yeah, it was an emotional hurt. I've never physically hurt, I don't think, anybody. But my grandfather taught me that when I was a kid. But I think being sometimes, you know, I mean, when you grow up, and for me, I was in the age of 14. And so through my teenage years, trying to learn boundaries was a struggle for me, right? Because I didn't have the parent upbringing, and my dad also had bipolar. So for me, it was, in my life now, I have loads of mentors. I have one mentor that's my mentor, but a lot of other support. I think that's the other thing too. I've been going to counseling for 16 years. And that's helped me to be stable and balanced. But I think a lot of people think that they don't need a counselor or they don't need extra support. And I always try to encourage people that if they've had anything that's challenging, I think that always calls for some sort of support or intervention, you know?
Well, yeah, and I think even if we look at society as a whole, one of the big things I'm all about is this idea of culture and community, is building a community, having an open home, you know, breaking bread with friends on a regular basis, having those role models, having time away with my male friends where we could just go and hang out and men and chat and talk about the things that hurt, talk about my things in my heart, you know, be able to share the whole truth. A lot of that sort of eroded through society and sort of is getting washed away a little bit. And really, I think what I'm hearing what you're talking about is that whole the whole organization, both organizations that you are leading, they're really about bringing people back together to talk about things that are important, right?
That's right. Yeah, we have one slogan for the BC Bereavement Helpline. It's bereavement support is an essential service. And then for the BC Victims of Homicide, healing through connection. And those, you know, the healing through connection is paramount. I mean, you know, in a time and a place where in Vancouver, I know probably all over the world, I'm imagining it's even more so, is this disconnect with, you know, the technology and with the crime rates, or with the population sizes increasing, we tend to be a little bit more skeptical about relationships and about trusting strangers and people. So I think it makes it even that much more important to make sure that you do reach out and have some networks. Even, you know, it's not always about quantity, it's about quality, right?
Right, right. So. And if you were sort of giving a message of the things you've learned, I mean, there are people out there who may never experience, and hopefully never experience, a bereavement through murder, but everyone's going to experience a bereavement at some point in their life. Even beyond the bereavement side of it, what is the message that you would like to impart in people, just in every day of how they show up and how we can, as a society, you know, be more connected, be more open, be more spontaneous? I mean, is there a message that you'd like to share with people?
Yeah, I have a couple. Like, I think the biggest one is, I think it's really important to be honest with each other, and the idea of sharing and talking about, you know, I think even listening, you know, sometimes we don't know how to relate to people, or we don't know what to say. And that's one of the most empty feelings is for people to not be able to ask you, you know, what was your mom's birthday, or what are you doing on Mother's Day, even though you don't have a mother, or, you know, just, I think just showing an interest and also showing that you're there to listen and talk, and you don't have to know what to say. And sometimes just saying that, I think, is really important.
I want to jump in what you said, because people may have missed that. What you're saying is, by you even saying, I don't know what to say, is enough to open the door of a connection, right?
Yeah, and very honest. I've never had a murder happen. I've never had that kind of, it doesn't matter if it's murder, it could be anything. I've never had a suicide. I've never had an abortion. I've never had, But I want to try to understand, and I want to try to be there for you however I can. And if it takes, us going for coffee every week, or you needed to come up, like, I think even if people say, if you need someone to call me at 3 a.m. That is one of the most helpful things I had was just someone to call. I mean, the late hours of the night, there's not always supports, there's not always helplines. There's not always, people that can call, because most people don't get like to be waken up that late. But if you start looking at the reality of some people's situations, they're at a very desperate and lonely time. And maybe all they need is just someone to answer the phone and talk to them for half an hour, and then you can go back to sleep. But maybe you save their life by just doing that, Sometimes I think we've got to be a little bit inconvenienced sometimes for a longer term, goal of betterment.
Yeah, and I know there was a second part to what you wanted to share, but I almost feel that there's a part here that beyond bereavement, like I said, beyond even any kind of hurt or regret, the concept of listening and being honest and showing up in a conversation and sharing and being of interest and opening yourself up to connect at any time, call me anytime, pop around anytime. I mean, that's a real societal kind of shift that could really change the world in a big way, right?
Oh yeah, it could. It even comes, like, even when people used to, my dad used to always take us to people's houses unexpectedly, and it's like, oh, let's go visit. Well, that was a thing kind of the past. Now though, I know some people some of my friends that actually have that. It's like an open door policy. Come by, stop by anytime. You don't have to call, just come over. If we're home, we're home. If we're not, we're not, And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's not really accepted because everybody's so busy. But I think that's an awesome way to live,
Well, it's really funny because I had a guy show up here today, Jason, and he's been texting me, and I don't use text that much, and I don't respond to my emails as much as I should or could. And, and I keep saying to him, just, you got an open invite, just show up, And today he just showed up, and I happened to be in the living room, and I was on the phone, and my door was wide open, and there was music playing, Van Morrison's playing, and he wanders in. And I said, "Hey, great." And I just hung up. He said, "You don't have to hang up." I said, "Of course I have to hang up. You just showed up in my house. Come and sit down." And we sat down and BS for an hour and a half, caught up. And for me, that spontaneity of the moment was so precious because, like you say, not everyone does it. And we always feel like it's an imposition. Yet, it really is one of those great gifts of a culture, right? Is that we can just pop into each other's homes and show up unexpectedly and not worry about the mess if there's a mess, or what the kids have left their dirty shoes in the hallway, whatever, right? It shouldn't be a big deal.
Yeah. No, it's for sure. It's a different way of thinking, it seems, but you gotta be creative, right? I think telling people too how much you appreciate them and that too goes a long way.
Is that the second part? You said there was kind of two parts to what you wanted to share, the message you wanted to give. Is it about that appreciation piece, or is there more?
Well, I think the second part is more practical. Getting these groups set up was, it almost put me over the edge. It was 4 years of go, 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 and I almost burned myself out in June. And I was in a motorcycle accident too last October, which made me question, and be just not question, but be so appreciative for my life. But now that we got this program running, I'd like to, put an ask out there that, there are many, many other, communities around the world that are affected by homicide. And like we've experienced here in Canada, there's very, very little support, for this type of victim. And so if you are at all interested in starting something, or you're interested in supporting the program we have in British Columbia, which we're looking to expand right across the country, and there's no definite plan, but from a funding perspective, from a volunteer perspective, a board member perspective, whatever you're willing to commit, I think it would be just great, great learning opportunity and a great contribution back to society. So I always like meeting new people. And so if there's some way you'd like to become involved, or if you just need guidance on how to start a program up in your city or town
part of the world even, right? Because it could be any country in the world, right?
Completely, yeah.
How does someone get a hold of you, Chris?
This is hopefully I don't get too overwhelmed here with the emails.
But, hey, be careful what you ask for.
Yeah, that's right. Eh? But I will give a website here, and there's one website for the BC Bereavement Helpline is BCBH, as in British Columbia Bereavement Helpline .ca. So BCBH.ca. Or the other one is victimsofhomicide.com.
And if someone wants to contact you, if they want to chat with you, they can get you through there, right?
That's right.
All right. So victimsofhomicide.com. That's awesome. You know, and, you know, what's great is you actually were sitting next to my business partner and my very, very close friend, Courtney, on a flight. And this is how this all came about. And I mentioned to you just before the call that I kind of had a gap on my call this week because I was busy and someone who was going to come on, he had something come up, and I thought to myself, I'm just going to trust that actually someone's going to pop into this in the next 12 hours. Someone's going to show up and be here for my call tomorrow, which is always with a guest. And this is we spoke for the first time 54 minutes ago, I think it was. And so I really appreciate you popping up and being here and sharing so openly and from your heart. And really, you know, a young man like you are, having gone through, like I say, there are 5 homicides in your direct sphere of influence, family members and friends and loved ones that you experienced in a short time. And I think your courage and your clarity of what's really important is so refreshing. And I just want to commend you and ask that you share, just as a celebration, I want to celebrate with you a little bit. You won a couple of big awards this last little while here. Can you share a couple of, we have about 2 minutes left here. Can you share a little bit about the awards you've won?
Sure. I think I mentioned the Queen Elizabeth II Diamond Jubilee Award. So that was one that was nominated by the Rick Hansen and the Canadian Parents of Murdered Children. So that was quite an honor to go to Ottawa and receive that. They did a nice celebration at City Hall. And the other one was the Rick Hansen organization. Rick Hansen was the man in motion, the one who wheelchaired around the world. 40,000 kilometers 25 years ago. Well, he just did his 25-year anniversary and had 7,000 medal bearers travel across Canada with a medal. And they nominated me as one of those medal bearers. And the really interesting thing is we have CTV, which is one of our national news companies here, selected the top 25 of the 7,000 medal bearers. They called them difference makers. And so I was on the top 25 list to do a national story with Lloyd Robertson, and that was really great. We reached about 2 million viewers through that medium. And I don't know, another award I guess that I got in university was a Student of the Year award for contribution to student life. And I don't like to focus too much on my own awards, but it really does exemplify the importance of what we're doing, and I think it brings a lot of credit back to the cause, and that's what I'm all about. I don't like it to be about me. I even try to minimize my sharing sometimes and try to find other victims who can, you know, speak to the same truths, right? Because it's not about me. I'm just one person,
you're one person who's made a significant difference in so many lives already, and mine right now. I'm really glad that you stepped into my life. I'm looking forward to meeting up. I know you're in Vancouver, I believe, right? So we're not too far away from each other. So hopefully we can get together for a cold one of these days.
That sounds great.
I want to ask you one last question. And the question is the show's called The Kick-Ass Life. You know, I wonder if you had to describe what a kick-ass life is to you, how would you describe the kick-ass life?
Kick-ass life? This is like the part I get to be spontaneous and innovative, right?
Yep.
I would probably scream right now. I'd probably give a nice scream. I think it's living no holds barred, you know? I think it's living with a full of anticipation and passion and drive, and not allowing the negativity to come in your mind, because there's a lot of negativity out there anyways. If you're trying to accomplish something and you got goals to set, you know, I just think you got to be very, very focused on not allowing that to be a part of your daily thoughts and processes. So,
well, Chris,
That was it.
Well, Chris, you know, we're at our 45-minute mark now. Thank you so much. I appreciate you very much, and I appreciate the work you're doing. And I send my love to you and to all the victims of homicide around the world that are obviously going through their process. And I do a call out to everyone listening to go out there and lend an ear, to reach out, to be available at 3 a.m. and to tell your truth to them. Maybe you don't understand, but you can be there for them. So, Chris, thanks so much, my friend.
Thank you very much.
All right, ciao.
Okay, bye-bye.
Was that amazing? I want to thank Courtney for having the wisdom to put us together. And so, Courtney, I send my love to you. You're getting married soon, and I can't wait. I'm emceeing the wedding, so I'm really excited about that, to be a part of you and Dan's special day. And Chris, thank you. Thank you so much. It's important, those words, you know, and I can't tell you all the work I've done and the journey I've been on. Forgiveness keeps coming up, and so many people hold on to so much little crap. And when you listen to someone like Chris, who's let go of so much, we can't call it little. It's not. It's massive. But I also, I think his words of wisdom around listening and being there for people, and how many people are out there today who are really feeling that they just want to connect. And I think we can, you know. And when people are going through, I mentioned my friend, Brandon Dancy from High River, Alberta. I remember his passing, you know, and driving. I was living in Caslow at the time, sort of 8 hours to go visit him, and how lonely he was because no one would come anymore, because he was definitely, you know, that was his last days, and how much we'd laugh and talk to each other, and he wanted to show me what was going on, and it was hard, but it was also, it was important. So I want you to think about that as, what role can we play to be more open, more, you know, to be able to listen? And if someone's going through some stuff, how do we step in there and just tell them the truth? I don't know. I don't know how to deal with this. I've never dealt with anything like this before, but I'm just here. If you want me, call me. You know, if you want to chat, it doesn't matter what it is, just call. You know, how great was that? So, you know, as I salute this young man, I want you to just say, out how many people feel that way. So, you know, just having that compassion, having that heart to reach out and do a little bit more, you know, be a little bit more present, notice. And I don't think, you know, I'm not a guy that goes around the world thinking I have to save people. I don't feel that way at all. But I do think that we can be more present in the world, be more alive, be more aware, be more open, be kinder, gentler, you know, sillier, but certainly have an open philosophy of life, you know. And I want to do a call out, actually. I bumped into a guy, he had a boat for sale in his garden, Graham, and he took us into his home for an hour and a half, talked about his things that were really important to him, and his, you know, the way he lives his life. And it was just awe-inspiring, because I kind of knew it was going to happen the moment I pulled up outside his house, you know. But that's what it's like to be strangers one minute and to know someone. And not, friendship is something that's developed over time. But having the courage and the heart to open up your doors, open up your home, open up your philosophies, and suddenly, you know, we're spending 2 hours in a stranger's house, and now he's no longer a stranger. In fact, we just got off the phone together, and I said to him, I'm committed. I collect people. It's my collection. It's people. And so go out there, collect some people, and ladies and gentlemen, make this a really kick-ass week, because you can. You know, it's all about choices. We can all choose. We can choose to be miserable. We can choose to be happy. We can choose to focus. We can choose to forgive. We can choose to be angry. It's up to us. This sounds a little bit like the Cat in the Hat. But I want you to choose. Choose a wonderful, open-hearted life. I don't know. I'm in that mood right now. But I want you to listen to Chris's words and know that people have been through so much stuff and found a way to not just live with it, but do something with it. Do something meaningful in the world and to make a shift happen in people's lives. And you don't have to do what Chris does, where he's taken on so much and running two amazing organizations. But you can reach out, and I urge you to reach out to people, reach out of your lives today. Notice what's going on. Listen to someone and see if you can practice that one line. Practice that, hey, you know what, call me anytime. Just call for a chat, all right? I'm always here, and I'm sure there's lots of people in your life. So have a great one, ladies and gentlemen. See you soon.
That was kick-ass.